sometimes these games happen. Frankly, sometimes they're needed. You know, I look back at our game out in Pittsburgh earlier this season. And I think from there, I think we might have went to Carolina, and that was really the start of some of the best hockey we played all season for a 6-7 week period of time. So sometimes you need these type of games as a true wake up. So a chance for us to play again tomorrow and start playing better.
I think there's some truth to that, Sheldon Keefe. I'm JD Bunkus, Ailish Forfar. It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Again, it's Text Line Tuesday, and a lot of you are fired up about the old Maple Leafs today, which makes sense because I am too. So Ailish has a lot in the text line, 590-590. Keep them coming throughout the day. You can hit me up on the DMs at JD Bunkus, both on Twitter and Instagram, at Ailish Forfar, same deal. Again, the theme of today is trying not to overreact to the things that have not been there in large samples. They are trying to react properly to the things that have been. If you want to talk about things the Leafs have done, it is bounced back from these horrific losses at times, right? Sometimes it doesn't happen like, oh, the very next night you assume that it's going to be, but usually they do round into being a pretty damn good hockey team. So I'm not going to indict them as trash because they lost the Habs. I thought they were going to win last night. When they started to lose, I thought this feels predictable. There are definitely some trouble signs, and I have obviously a bunch of things that are really starting to pile up and aggravate me, and I'm not really sure what the solutions are. I'm hoping that my buddy Ian Tuller can help me out with them. I'm a fan of small sample sizes and only looking at box scores. Ian Tuller, how's it going, buddy?
Not too bad. Yeah, that encapsulates me perfectly. I appreciate that intro.
Hey, you got a new job. I'm proud of you, though, for real. Ian Tulloch, hockey analyst and writer for the Hockey News. Congrats,
buddy.
Hell
yeah. Yeah, thanks, man. Looking forward to writing a few pieces per week for them. So that should be fun when we start that up.
Listen, I know I tease you, but it's because I actually do read you, and I do like your work. And I do find that you, on balance, are someone that doesn't just live by the numbers, who does watch the games, and who does try his very best to, I think, like, go through those numbers properly. Like, I think that a lot of people will look at these things and they'll use them to shape a narrative, right? And that's sort of what I hate about analytics, is that it gets used sometimes by people as this kind of conclusive, take that whatever someone is saying is wrong. Whatever someone is doing is actually overstated, or here's the actual facts of the matter. When in reality, you know, I don't think that the sport represents the best when it comes to those numbers, and I think that it's really hard for them to reflect in the facts. So I'm going to start with a couple of things. I'm going to start with John Tavares. You look at his numbers, and you look across the board, and it tells you a story of a guy that his points per game is up from actually his last two seasons. His goals per game is actually up from a season ago. You look at all these numbers, his Corsi, his Fenwick, all of them on balance seem like, okay, this isn't the worst. But then you remember that he makes $11 million and that context matters. And my point off of the top of the show is he doesn't feel like he's playing with enough force lately where, okay, he's a force in the offensive circle, like in the dot. He wins his faceoffs at an extremely good rate. But he's someone who's getting offensive zone starts at a rate that he never has before, 70% this season almost. He's only got 11 goals 5-on-5. What are the numbers that you're looking at right now with Tavares? What are the numbers telling you about his game right now?
I think the one that I always like bringing up is the one that I brought up to you. It was either a month or two ago when Kerfoot was scoring at an all-time high rate. That line seemed to be clicking on all cylinders when you looked at the points, you looked at the production, but I try to look a little bit beneath that, and scoring chances and shots are the two things that I find very simple. It's something you can communicate to a coach, to a fan, or to a hockey nerd like myself, and they all seem to agree that, yeah, you want to outshoot the opposition. You want to get more scoring chances than your opponent. It's a very simple concept. The Kerfoot-Tavares-Nylander line in a large sample this season has been hovering around 50% in both those metrics. That's not where you want to be when you're an elite player in this league. And it's hard to assign blame when it's a trio of players who you would think would be performing better than that. Nylander this season as a whole has looked fantastic, but I don't know how much of that is on him. With Tavares, I think his inability defensively to make plays, I think slowing down, I think the fact that he's on the back half of that contract, I don't think the 200-foot value is where you'd want it to be. And then what's the solution to that problem? Because if that's not your second line heading into the playoffs, because clearly the sum of the parts isn't what you'd want it to be, do you have to move Kerfoot down? Do you move Kasha up into that top six? There's options to look at, but I think as a whole, that trio never really has been performing at the rate that they were performing at earlier in the season. That was never going to last. I know I like to talk about expected goals with you. One of my buddies texted me last night. He's like, the goals and the expected goals are finally lining up for this line. It's almost like this was expected. And I know that's the nerdiest thing you could say on the radio, but I had to say it.
Okay, so what do you think the solution is then? You floated a couple ideas around on how you can spark the second line with Tavares and even Nylander not having the most impact as of late. Do you know what you would do? Do you have any inklings of like somebody that might be able to internally fit there to help boost some production?
I think that's the hard part, because someone like Pierre Engvall or Ilya Mikheyev, even though you like them in a bottom six, offensively, you don't trust them to make plays off the rush with a Tavares or Nylander. So I don't think that's the right fit there. Andre Kasha is someone who never got a look in the top six with Tavares and Nylander. He worked with Matthews. Every time you play him with skilled players, he seems to do well. Health is the main concern with him. So I'd like to see a Tavares, Nylander, Kasha, I guess move Nylander over to the left wing. I think that's something that could work potentially, and it's hard because we can talk about using assets to add a forward at the deadline, but I think everyone and their mother wants the Leafs to trade for a defenseman. I know they traded for Ilya Lyubushkin recently, and I'm sure that's something we're going to talk about. Everyone in the city of Toronto is now an Ilya Lyubushkin expert, myself included, so that should be fun to break down. But I think realistically heading into the deadline, those assets would still probably be best used on a defenseman who can play in the top four. So I think you are looking for that answer internally. And I'm not sure if you're going to find it, which is a bit concerning to me.
So, yes, especially if Jake Muzzin is hurt for a significant period of time. I know some people are already spinning that into, oh, well, now you have LTIR and you rest until the playoffs and you do all these different things. And I don't know. I think that you need to make sure that you have a better blue line, because to me, there are three guys that you do not want playing in a postseason series. As of today, there's three. And maybe Lyubushkin solves one of those problems, but I still would like two of these guys to not be playing in a postseason. And so I need to at least have one extra body in here. And if Muzzin's hurt and Muzzin's out for a long period of time, I don't even know what you do. I truly look at this blue line and say it is in just a dire, dire straits. So you're telling me that you got to use assets to try and supplement your $11 million center and your $7 million winger? That just doesn't seem to make sense to me. I don't really want that to happen. I think that's a best case scenario if things started to work out for you and your blue line was healthy and something started to coalesce and maybe you hit on Rasmus Sandin playing his offside next to Muzzin and all of a sudden you went, you know what, there's a luxury here, there's a player with control, there's a player who's undervalued, we're going to use an asset here to acquire them. Fine. But the idea that you would be going out and trying to add to that line is terrifying. Really, it is. And this kind of gets me to the core thing, man, is this is what I'm trying to bring up with you is, okay, so Tavares is getting those numbers and Nylander's getting his numbers. Kind of overall, you step back and say this picture should be fine, and yet it doesn't feel fine. And so if we're putting this on Alex Kerfoot, I think that's an issue. I think that's a real, 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 real big problem. I don't know if you start to cycle up your lines because your first line is so dominant you don't want to break them up. Even if you're talking about putting Kasha up there, now you're tinkering with the other line that's working. Now you're tinkering with the other one thing that works. I don't know if we're overreacting to this problem or if it's something that is, yeah, maybe even tracking in a worse direction, considering that those numbers you referenced have been trending downwards over this entire month.
Yeah, I think the fact that the Matthews line has been so dominant has helped mask some of this. And I know you mentioned in the text heading into this conversation that Matthews being a legitimate heart candidate is probably something we need to talk about, because he's on pace to, I think Dom Lucian's latest projections have him hitting 60 goals this year while having Selke impact. I mean, no player in NHL history has ever done that. So you have a guy who could win the Selke, the Rocket, and the Hart in the same season. At 5-on-5, whoever he plays with, that line's controlling well over 60% of the quality chances at 5-on-5. They're dominant when he's on the ice. The biggest issue is when the second line's on the ice, they're not dominating play. Strangely enough, the Engvall-Kampf-Kasha combination, or the Mikheyev-Kampf-Kasha combination, that line's been really good. So the third line, weirdly seems to be solved. The first line is clearly solved. It's the second line and the second pairing right now that everyone in Leafs Nation is trying to fix. We could switch over to the defense if you'd like and talk about Ilya Lyubushkin, because I know one of the players that you don't want to see in the Leafs lineup in the playoffs is Timothy Liljegren, and I have the hot, nerdy take that I didn't think Liljegren and Sandin together on a third pair were a problem, but I guess for the Leafs, the biggest issue is it's not a guy in sheltered minutes that you're worried about, because you figure that pairing is going to work no matter what if Sandin's there. You're trying to find someone who you can trust against tougher competition to shut down leads, and that's something that Ilya Lyubushkin has done over the last couple of years. So I'm curious to see what the Leafs' blue line is going to look like now, because, frankly, I don't think Muzzin and Lyubushkin are a fit together if neither of them can move the puck. I've done some research and pairings in the NHL and play styles, and when you put two non-puck movers together, historically, it rarely works out. I know the Leafs had a Marincin-Polak pairing a few years back that bizarrely outshot and outchanced competition, but that doesn't happen very often. For the most part, when you put two non-puck movers together, they get stuck in their own end. Yes, they defend the rush well. Yes, they box out and defend against the cycle decently, but they have trouble advancing play up the ice, and they're usually on the wrong side of the shot and scoring chance markers. So does that leave you with a Sandin-Lyubushkin third pair, and you're still looking for that second pair right D? I think realistically that's where this team's going to be come trade deadline. So that's why I didn't love the trade. Even though you got rid of Nick Ritchie, who you needed to get rid of, I don't think it truly solved what the biggest issue is for this team. So maybe you were never going to do that Nick Ritchie trade, but I still think there are holes to fill on this roster.
Okay, so you said that you're becoming, or you have become, a Ilya Lyubushkin expert, and so has the whole city, it feels like, ever since that he's been added to the team. How do you translate his stats and his numbers from a team that is so bad? How do you know coming in, like, what he could actually bring to this team? Especially, like, you know, we were looking at the basic stats that people like me can understand, plus minus. And he was, you know, minus six on a team that's like minus 48. Like, is that going to translate well? Is that just because he's, you know, maybe more of an offensive threat? Like, what do we actually have in him? And what can Leafs fans expect when he maybe makes the roster tonight?
Yeah, everyone sprinted to the stats that they could understand on Lyubushkin the second he was traded, because let's face it, I don't know how many of us are watching the Arizona Coyotes right now, and I wouldn't blame you. I don't think they're the most fun team in the NHL to watch these days. But when it comes to Lyubushkin, the plus-minus on a bad team, whenever you're playing a decent amount of minutes, you're going to be on the ice for goals again. So that's just how it works. It's the unfortunate nature of it. So some of the things I try to look at when I'm evaluating a player who's clearly on a terrible team: who is he playing against? Who is he playing with? And when he's on the ice at 5-on-5, what's happening in terms of the shots and the scoring chances? It's a very simple thing you can do. He's played against tough competition over the last few years. Now, he's also played alongside some good players, whether it's Jacob Chychrun this year or Oliver Ekman-Larsson in previous years. So that makes it a bit hard to parse the results, because obviously the better player is probably the one who's impacting more of the game. But consistently throughout Lyubushkin's career over the last, let's call it, three seasons, he's been on the ice and very few scoring chances go in against him. Also, very few scoring chances for his team happen as well. He kind of kills the game. Remember when the Leafs traded for Riley Nash? When he's on the ice, nothing happens. When a fourth-line center, a defensive specialist, is on the ice, David Camp comes to mind. Nothing happens when that player's on the ice. And that's not a bad thing. When you have a team like the Leafs who has some offensive firepower, coaches like a guy that you can throw out there for 40 seconds, kill a shift, kill it in the neutral zone, dump it in, don't let the other team carry it past your blue line, and we'll just play sludge hockey for 40 seconds. That's not a terrible thing, but also you have to remember the limitations of the player. You can trust him defensively in the third period when you're closing out a one-goal lead. Lyubushkin certainly has a lot of value, but when you're trailing and you're trying to get back into the game and you need to make a breakout pass out of your defensive zone and advance play up the ice, that's not something Lyubushkin's typically good at. So good depth add, good defensive defenseman, but frankly, I didn't think the third pair was the problem for Toronto, and if they think he's going to solve the second pair, I'm highly skeptical that that's going to work, but I think that's based more on Jake Muzzin's play than anything.
So this is where you and I philosophically disagree so greatly. This is like our greatest point of divergence. To me, this Leafs team, absolutely. If Ilya Blubushkin comes in here and he can do some of those things that you just said, that is a massive, massive, massive win for this team. Because they do not have guys that are good or comfortable on the ice when you're trying to protect leads or you are trying to kill a play in your own end. And that's one of the most frustrating things about this Leafs team this season is that even when their top defensive pairing is on the ice with Brody and with Riley, how do they break up plays? With their sticks. Like, that's what Brody does, right? He's an elite player with his stick, an elite mind. Morgan Riley can make those breakout passes when those guys get the puck. But there's so few guys on this roster that go out there and play with a real physical edge. And I really do think that from every single person that I've ever talked to or every single hockey game that I've ever watched, having players on your team that have bite matter. Like, they just do. Are they a thing like you should blow up and make your entire identity around them like Brian Burke did? Is that a smart play? I think we saw no pretty conclusively that it's not the way that you're going to end up winning a Stanley Cup. But for Toronto, where they're going to lose Jake Muzzin, and frankly, I think one of the things that has sucked with Muzzin this year is that he just doesn't look like he's able to play as physical anymore. That he has gone into the season knowing that his version of load management for hockey is the same thing that Wayne Simmonds has done, where he said, I need to focus more on keeping my body right, and that involves a little less physical play, that involves maybe a little less fighting if you're Wayne Simmonds, and that involves less hitting if you're Jake Muzzin. Toronto desperately needs a player who hits guys, who can thump somebody, who can change a game with a hit, who can change a game by rubbing somebody on the boards and just taking them out of a play and getting the puck to somebody. So yeah, do I need every single one of my defensemen to make a elite breakout pass? It'd be nice, but do I prioritize having six guys that all do that over prioritizing six guys that, you know, or over having balance in your lineup where I can have at least one guy who does the things that this dude is supposed to do? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So I hope, because I'm saying I hope because I'm with the normal people that have no idea who this guy is, that this guy can step in and do that job. Because if he can, I think that it solves one of your issues.
Yeah, and when it comes to player evaluation and trying to balance the roster in terms of guys who are offensively talented and guys who are defensively talented, I think that's clearly something the Leafs have been trying to address over the last year or so. You look at the deadline last year. Did they try to acquire more skill? No, they went for a Nick Foligno type, someone who could help them when they're protecting a lead. In the offseason, David Kampf was a big addition for Dubas, and that one's worked out pretty well. So they clearly value players who can help them when they're winning, and that's obviously something that matters. When it comes to the bite and the physicality, I know that there's productive toughness, and I know that you can go in and win a puck battle and maintain possession and make the next play, and that's something that every coach wants. I do get worried when we overvalue it a little bit and then Ben Chiarot gets linked to Toronto. I don't know how real that was, but the fact that there are even whispers about it to me is a little concerning, just because if you're looking to add a player who was dead last on the Montreal Canadiens in the playoffs in 5-on-5 shots against, scoring chances against, goals against, differential, he was dead last in every single metric throughout the playoffs. That NHL GM seemed to think that Ben Chiarot played well. This is where I get worried, because we're talking about a player who every single metric says that when he was on the ice, bad things were happening, but he hit someone, so now we like him. I want guys who can do that physical part, separate a player from the puck, but also advance it up the ice and make sure your team still has it.
Sure.
I think when it comes to hockey, I think so many times we overrate that physical aspect of things, but I also think that the nerds like myself, we're probably underselling the impact of it. So I don't know. The reality is probably somewhere in the middle, just like it always is.
You absolutely are. And that's the thing. It's like moderation, right? You go, too much of one thing is bad for you. And that's the same thing with, I think, a hockey team. Too much of one thing when it comes to building a blue line might be bad. You can point to these numbers with Sandin and Liljegren together, right? Or Liljegren's numbers as a whole this season and his analytics and his shot share and all this stuff. And you go, well, this is what you need to value. This is what you need to value because this ends up being a positive thing in the ledger that we have. But we've talked about this before. Analytics don't measure defensive impact as well. And shot suppression stuff and all the defensive numbers that we have, they're just not as easy to quantify still to this day what those impacts do. It's kind of like fielding in baseball. We have a idea we can actually trend some of it or track some of it and say, well, this guy is better than this guy probably based on this number, but it really isn't an exact science. And so with somebody like Liljegren, who's on a team full of offensively talented players, right? On a team that often night in, night out is the favorite. Like, how often do you see the Leafs as the betting underdog in a game? On a team where he gets to get offensive zone draws with Austin Matthews in front of him, or even John Tavares, who we've said isn't up to snuff, but guess what? Just like there's a play last night where Tavares wins a draw in the offensive circle, and he gets to drive the net. Liljegren goes to the outside and drives the net because he gets the puck on his stick. And I go, that's a really positive play for him. That's the kind of play I want to see him make, but that's not what it's always going to be, is just him being able to feast on that bad lineups in the postseason. The defensive stuff matters with these guys, and I think that that is much harder to quantify with a team that wins as many games as the Maple Leafs do. Like, they win a ton of games, they outscore the crap out of their opponents, and you end up looking at all these stats. Like, I remember, I love Anthony Petrelli's work. You and I both do. He's a really, really good writer. He wrote this thing like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, about how Justin Hall's season, and I'm not saying this to call out Anthony, because like, honestly, most of his stuff I agree with, but he wrote this thing about how if you look at Hall's analytics, they're not so bad. And I go, yeah, because the team is really good. The team is amazing. So if you put a guy who can make a pass with really good players, that is usually going to come out in the wash as this is a really positive player. But when you look at what this team absolutely doesn't have enough of, it is guys who can kill those spots. You know, what have Morgan Rielly and John Tavares been talking about the last 2 days, right? It's defending better against the rush. Is that something that you think Timothy Liljegren does well? Is that something that anybody on this team does well? At this point, it's kind of a moot one because, hell, their blue line is so thin that everybody basically needs to play. But I do think that one of the core issues that we have when we have these discussions, like you and I and everybody who does eye test versus analytics, who makes these into these big wide sweeping things, is that both sides are overvaluing the thing that they hold dear. And both sides are basically just working in the same exercise of confirmation bias every time something either goes their way or goes against them.
I think you just described the human condition there. So let me see if I can unpack some of that, because I totally agree when it comes to trying to use defensive numbers to evaluate anything in hockey, because goaltending is kind of the big mystery in this sport. We have nothing that can predict future goaltending performance at a decent rate. So how do you use defense then at that point? It reminds me of baseball when you're trying to isolate for a pitcher's impact relative to the defense behind him. In hockey, you have the goaltender and you have the defense in front of you. Clearly, there's a huge relationship there, but we're really bad at measuring that. We're really bad at assigning value to it. So the best way that we can measure players in terms of predictive aspects, offensively, we have really good predictive metrics. Defensively, we don't have the best predictive metrics. The best things we probably have right now are those zone entry defense and preventing chances off the rush. And for Toronto's top 10 in a lot of metrics this year, they're top 5 in a few things. They're top 1 in power play. But one of the areas where they rank really low, and you mentioned it, it's defending the rush. And Timothy Liljegren, I don't think he's the worst in the world at it. I think there are worse players on the Leafs than him at it. But you mentioned it. Who on the Leafs is a good rush defender? TJ Brody. And then I'm not sure if you can make an argument for anyone being above average. Jake Muzzin used to be significantly above average at it. But due to injuries and a lack of foot speed and, like you say, game managing himself, load managing himself throughout an 82-game season, doesn't seem to be the best rush defender right now. That is somewhere where Ilya Lyubushkin grades out positively. So again, that's another sign that they're trying to fill this need of they're addressing team defense, they're addressing rush defense. Sheldon Keefe, the team in their last few interviews, you can listen to their answers. They're all talking about the defensive play. I don't think anyone in Toronto is concerned about the possession style in the offensive zone or the offensive output. That seems to be there. It's the overall commitment to team defense. And like you said, that's the toughest aspect of hockey to measure right now. And I think even at the NHL, when you look at some of the private stuff they're using, it's still tough to parse out real value. It's real tough to parse out noise from actual signal and what's going to be predictive of future results. So I can sit here and tell you that I know exactly how well Lyubushkin is going to play in the next couple games, but there are so many effects when a player changes team, when a player changes structure, when he changes line mates, that I don't have a confident answer for you, but I can tell you that the next player the Leafs acquire is probably going to be in that Lyubushkin mold of a player who helps the team defend and helps the team when they're up by a goal, not who helps them when they're down by a goal and need some offense. So that's kind of where I'm at when it comes to the player evaluation on the Leafs.
I still hope that that is the case, because I really, really think that the number one need, again, barring a complete no coming back from Jake Muzzin off of this injury, is that they add a top four defenseman on the right side, that they add a partner that can play with Muzzin night in, night out. But what I actually want to see over the next month or whatever, I guess I'm assuming that he's out for a long time, but what I want to see when he's out is certainly the Sandin and Liljegren thing. I don't think that those two guys can handle a playoff matchup together, even though the numbers are very, very friendly with them. I know I'm not going to trust them in the defensive zone. I know I'm not going to trust them against a heavy team that can get in on a forecheck and just kind of punish those guys and be able to get to the net front easily, especially against this goaltending. But I at least want to see what that sample looks like over a larger one, and I want to see what it looks like against better competition night in, night out. That's more meaningful to me than getting a look at Lyubushkin and Sandin right now. That's more meaningful to me than anything else you can do. And by the way, the number one case that you should just be using for anybody that wants Liljegren off the lineup right now is simply that he's obviously so much better than Justin Hall. That they just need to find a way to dump Justin Hall, because that's got to be priority number one for Kyle Dubas right now. Like, I actually think that it's Nick Ritchie level import, where you go, hey, it doesn't matter. This guy needs a fresh change of scenery. This guy needs to go. You need to balance your lineup in a different way. We got to run. This was really long, but this was really good as always. I appreciate it, buddy. And I really, congrats on the job. And everybody knows Ian Tulloch. You follow him, you feel a little bit smarter. He's at
Ian Graf. Or dumber, Graf. Because you're like, I don't know if
you get halfway into it, you don't know what's happening anymore.
No, you will be smarter. At least, like, again, I like that you challenge other people's thoughts. Even, like, you know, the fact that I thought a lot of Leafs Twitter went with right with the grain on the Lyubushkin thing. It was so predictable. People going like, wow, it's perfect. It's amazing. It's the best trade ever. And again, I think that you're someone who's very deep into the Leafs Twitter, and you had a different take. And I will always respect that about you. Ian Tulloch, hockey analyst and writer for the Hockey News. Again, follow Matt Ian Graf. We'll talk to you soon, buddy.
It feels weird to hear you say nice things about me, but I appreciate it, JD. Strange. You guys have a good morning.
Yeah, I'm so hard on you. Ian Tulloch, good guy. I don't know, Ailish. To me, you need that balance. And, like, they can't defend off the rush, and they can't kill plays in their own end. And so I think Lyubushkin's going to be a huge fan favorite. I think he's exactly what they need. The problem with Lyubushkin is I don't know who you play him with. Because it feels like if he's a fourth guy, that's too much to ask of him based on what everyone has said and based on the fact that he's less than $1 million player on the Arizona Coyotes also. And two is that you can't supplement him with Muzzin now. I think Ian's case of two non-puck moving guys is a good one, especially considering that every scouting report on this guy I got back was when he tries to do too much with the puck, he burns you. And so, okay, you bump him down the lineup. Who's he playing with? Sandin would actually probably be the ideal one, right? Mm-hmm. But now you need Sandin to be in a bigger role. Are you asking those two guys to be your second pairing? I don't know. So. You can't have them be with Dermott. So that's it. It's just like, once again, the puzzle pieces still don't fit, and they get even more complicated when you don't have Jake Muzzin.
And it led to, after talking to Ian, the idea of, okay, they clearly need to find another fit for Lyubushkin especially, because if you're going to bring someone in that might be able to do something different, you don't want to waste it by putting him with someone that doesn't compliment him, right? And that's that whole conversation we were having about, are they just putting the lines in a blender too much on the back end? Like, how do you create chemistry? Yep. Well, maybe you need to get someone that works with him. And I know they're going to need to, like, it's the more you talk about it, and especially with someone like Ian who knows the stats, they're going to need to add someone else. But he said someone around that caliber is probably who they'll be getting. So yeah, I actually will say that I'm really excited to see what he brings, though. Like, I feel like tonight is, like, actually I feel a little bit excited about his performance. Not that there's a little bit of pressure.
Though.
I know. Well, why would he not? Like, come on.
I know. He's got to play.
He's got to get in there. Like, we got to see him. We got to know what he's bringing. Obviously, if Muzzin's out too, get him in there quick. Get him to meet the team while he's in the locker room. That's always fun. So potentially we see him tonight. But Ian does a good job at kind of giving you context to why you feel a specific way about something. I think Leafs Twitter was excited to read the simple stats like I was. Oh, great. Sounds like a good guy. But he gave a lot more context to, like, what you can expect and who he might play well with, which doesn't seem like there's an answer right now. So,
well, you know what, though? I also think there's two other components to this. which we can overrate. Like he said, if you overrate it and you say it's everything, then you're probably wrong. But if you quantify it properly, which is that it's a something, you're probably going to end up being right. The team getting him now is a shot in the arm. They're in a bit of a tough spot. They're not defending the rush well, and they're not a very physical team. And all of a sudden, they get a physical player who defends the rush better than most defensemen that they have. So, yeah, that's going to make them feel a little bit better. I will always, always, always believe in the, this guy makes someone feel taller. This makes someone feel bigger when they have them on the ice. And I'm sorry, but there's just no way that the Leafs feel all that confident about Timothy Liljegren going into the corner and, you know, hitting somebody and getting the puck from them and saying, don't worry, Timothy's going to go on the ice and make a play for us. They're going to say, hopefully he puts one tape to tape, because that's the one thing that he can absolutely do better than a lot of other guys. Anyways, before we take the break, it's time for Something to Chew On, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
What have you got for me today? Oh, yum, yum, yum. This one is kind of a foreshadowing or a look backwards at the Olympics. So we're going to have our newest Olympic gold medalist, Anne-Renée Desbien, on the show in 30 minutes. So I was wondering about how it works with Olympic medals, because I know that there are some bonuses and I know that the IOC themselves doesn't pay prize money to medalists. So I did some research and got a table of what the Olympic bonuses are per country. Singapore pays out, and this is converted to US dollars. Okay, so just keep that in mind. Singapore, if you win a gold medal for Singapore, winter or summer Olympics, you're paid $737,000 for gold, $369,000 for silver, and $184,000 for bronze. Where do you think Canada falls into what a gold medal pot to you when you return home? Singapore is the most. $737,000 to bring home gold. Where are we for Canada?
I think if you get a gold medal, you should get $100,000. At least. We don't get $100,000 if you get a gold medal?
$16,000.
16?
16, 1-6.
Okay, that's tough.
Yeah.
That's the United States. Although I don't know where the money's coming from, but I just feel like $100,000 is a fair price. Unless, you know what though? It should be based on sport. I'm sorry, but if you win if you win a sport, like if you win hockey, you get lots. you know?
Well, if it's longer tournament, right? You had to
win that's it. That's what I'm saying. If you win, I don't want to say a sport because it'll make someone mad, but if you win anything with what the frozen penis guy did, cross-country skiing, you get none. Like, you get $16,000 because you're a cross-country skier. You're already rich and you're already privileged. I almost swore to, like, through your nose because you're cross-country skiing. So, like, who cares? Like, you don't need the money. You're fine.
So this is data from CNBC in case anyone's going to cross examine it. So Singapore, $737,000.
That's too much though. But if you're Singapore, it's not, because you'd be your first one ever. So it's like fake money.
Okay, so you said around $100,000. So around $100,000, there's two numbers kind of on either side. Brazil pays $50,000 per gold medal, and Hungary pays $168,000 per gold medal. So kind of in the
middle. Also want to say that I'm learning of this context for the first time with you giving me Singapore $700,000. And now that I'm thinking about it, if you win more medals as a country, you got to pay less because they're less special. So it's kind of a good thing that we're near the bottom. I don't know. Now I'm torn on it. Maybe we should give nothing. Maybe it should just be the honor of going out there and representing your country is enough.
I mean, I feel like that's a really beautiful way of thinking, JD. But
why does everybody need to get paid for everything? I mean, I do. but why does it just I don't get to represent Canada? If they said, JD, you got to represent Canada at the radio host Olympics, I would do it for free. I would wear the flag proudly and just do it. Just
the lot
to
take the test determined that was a lot.
That's not true, Vic. You know that. You know I'm a true patriot. You know I'm the true patriot. So yeah, I don't know. I kind of torn on that now. I don't know.
Okay, well, below Canada was Australia with 15,000. Canada, 16,000. Where do you think the U.S. lands before we take a break?
Free.
Gold medal. Free? No way.
Yeah, that's what I said.
USA not too far up. They pay 37 $1,000 per gold medal. So a little bit higher than Canada, almost double Canada. This is in U.S. dollars. But something to chew on is if you want to go play for the Singapore national team in any sport and you make $737,000 for a gold medal, better start training. The Winter Olympics are 4 years away.
Well, that's the precedent for the Olympics now, right? Ever since, what's her name? What did she do? Ski for China, the American girl that decided to just stab her country in the back where she trained and was born and raised her entire life. And then everyone went, oh, that's so cool. It's like the least cool story ever. It was brutal. She's just making like tens of millions of dollars like representing China now as the best. But yeah, that's it. It doesn't matter. Olympics is just, hey, do you have an affiliation where you can go get more money? Can you go get Singapore? Sure. That's what's cool now.
Great. Well, that was something that you won. Let's take a break and we're going to get back into Text Line Tuesday or sourcing your Leafs thoughts and also who you would want to be on a panel or interview with. Somebody called it the hot tub question where you got four people in a hot tub. Who does it want to be? It's kind of similar to that. So text those in. Let's take a break and we'll be back on the Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
The most opinionated Maple Leaf show out there. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. It's 7:43, and this is the first time that JD's remembered to mute all show. Yeah. Congratulations, JD. We made it. It's almost learner. Halfway through. Fast learner. Yes. Proud of you. It's Text Line Tuesday, so 590-590. Hit us up. We are obviously taking your Leafs anxieties all day. Lots of those in the text line. Yes, dozens, really, in the text line. Also, I set up during the A-list that Eli Manning would want to interview Obama, and so we got talking about who would you want to interview that's not an athlete. Lots of those responses in the text line, and a lot of them happen to be Kanye or Antonio Brown. It's coming from Sean from Pickering, who's the Alpine Milk guy. He
wrote Antonio Brown?
Yeah, he says, the better the interview gossip you could get out of them, so I'd say either Kanye or Antonio Brown.
Wild. All right.
On the same line of thinking that JD said Trump would be better than Obama because of the stuff they would spill. So then I was telling JD during the break about this whole Kanye,
Antonio Brown know about?
Shannon, true. Shannon Sharp drama. So this was going to be an A-list segment. Shannon Sharp has caught wind of Kanye West and Donda Sports wanting to buy the Broncos, okay? So there's been some weird tweets coming out being like, let's go. Antonio Brown saying that he wants to buy the Broncos with Kanye West.
Uh-huh.
And so Shannon Sharp goes, I'd be happy to be a minority supporter of this. I think it'd be great. I'm all in on Kanye buying the Broncos. It's just a bit of a fiasco. The Broncos are also listed at $3.75 billion as of last year, Forbes. What are your thoughts on this whole little news cycle?
Well, Kanye doesn't have that kind of scratch. And if he's going around trying to get Antonio Brown and Shannon Sharp as his kick-in guys, then they're going to come up probably around $3 billion short of the price of acquisition here. I got to believe that. We'll see. Maybe I'm wrong, but sure seems to me that Kanye is not doing so hot right now. As a follower of his on Instagram who sees him post about 7 stories a day going after Pete Davidson or talking about STEM player, which I do not believe is going to be a success, punting on a bunch of money from Apple Music and from Spotify in order to try and launch a streaming service that I'm guessing is not going to work out very good, especially considering the price of this service, which is, I believe, around $200. Yeah, so Kanye...
He's trying to raise money for the Broncos.
Listen, I love Ye. I really do. One of my favorite artists of all time. And has given me 2 of my favorite, I'll say, 15 albums ever. This is not the time to buy Kanye stock. Like, he's surrounding himself with Antonio Brown. That's a bad sign. Imagine being a Broncos fan and wanting him to buy the Broncos. Like, do you really want multiple Instagram posts a day about Kanye feeling upset about one of the other NFL owners? I mean, I kind of do for the content, but if you're a fan of that team, I would say that the last thing on earth you want is Kanye to be the owner of your team right now. He's a successful businessman, and he's been successful in a variety of different areas. So maybe football is one, but I would say probably not this particular one at this particular time would be my advice. So yeah, mm-hmm. Shannon Sharp, good for your show and good for your tweets and you getting in the news. Bad for your I want to see Shannon Sharp actually put his money where his mouth is there, where it's like you become business partners with Kanye West on a football team. Okay, we'll see.
Did you know that ever since Antonio Brown had his little outburst, he's now become president of Donda Sports?
Yeah, listen, I don't think that Antonio Brown should be the president of anything. So, like, not a tree club, like a treehouse club. I wouldn't let him be president of anything. So if he's the president of Donda Sports, then that's your opening in the email for why we're getting it. And I go, that will be the end of this correspondence. How are the texts?
Great. Do you want to start with people that you want to interview, or do you want to start with Leafs?
No, give me some Leaf stuff. And also, 9 o'clock hour, basically the entire hour after Stewie is going to be text. So keep them coming, keep them coming. 590, 590. Hit me up in the DMs, Ailish too. Like, I want to read those as well. I get time during the breaks to actually read the ones in the DMs. So
okay,
keep them coming. So yeah, give me something good on the Leafs.
Mr. Mike from Toronto. There's no mystery to the Leafs' issues. They are built backwards. Look at the Jays and the Raptors. When the Jays pitch well and when the Raptors defend well, they are good. The Leafs are not a good defensive team and therefore are very vulnerable when the intensity of the playoffs ramps up.
So I don't like just painting problems as like, oh, well, it's just this one thing. Because if it was that simple, then everybody would figure it out. And everybody who won a Stanley Cup would have a sick blue line and forwards wouldn't really matter and blah, 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 blah. So no offense to this person, but I think that's a really simplistic way of looking at the Leafs' problems. Mm. They're obviously a really good team. They're obviously a really good team. There's a reason why they went to 7 games with the Bruins twice. There's a reason why they look as good as they do sometimes, because they're really good. There's a reason why their record is the way that it is, right? That's a large sample thing. You go over it and you say the Leafs are a good team. It's undeniably true. They have maybe the best player in hockey this season in Auston Matthews. Okay, we don't need to make the case that he's the best player on the planet, but this year, right now, he's going the best. They have one of the best lines in hockey.
Mm-hmm.
They have more forward depth than they have had in years past, more workable forward depth in years than they've had in years past. They still have a few good defensemen who can really play and eat up at least, you know, TJ Brody and Morgan Rielly can give you a reliable 20 plus minutes a night in a postseason series. We've seen Jack Campbell play up to the level where we talked about, could he get into the Vezina conversation?
Yeah.
So the Leafs are good. But when you're trying to win, you have to win just about as many places as you possibly can, right? You have to find little inefficiencies, especially in a salary cap era, and capitalize on them. You have to have wins above replacement. And right now, their blue line is starting to become a mess. But guess what? The Pittsburgh Penguins won a Stanley Cup as they were going into their like 8th and 9th defenseman, and everybody thought Ron Hainsey was a machine for them. So it's clearly not just one way of doing things. So I don't know. If that's your philosophy with team building, I can say that, yeah, I'd rather have an incredible goaltender and a staunch blue line going into the postseason than a high-end forward group. I agree with like that philosophically, but I don't think that there's just like they're not built for the playoffs or whatever because they have more high-end forwards with skill than they do blue liners who suppress shots.
Okay, so here is a solution possibly from Paul from Peterborough. Good morning, everyone. Feeling pretty dejected as a Leafs fan this morning. To me, all cards are on the table, including trading Willie for a top-tier D-man. JD, don't blast me too hard on this take.
No, hey, here's the thing. I don't think that you're doing anything like that drastic in season, and this is sort of one of the lessons that I hope or I thought we learned during last offseason, which is when you're emotional about something, you're usually going to deliver some pretty wild takes. I had one guy in my mentions yesterday who tweeted, Tavares for Price. I went, oh my God.
What?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. I was like, Carey Price isn't playing this season. He's older and much worse. And Tavares is much better and younger and more valuable and across the board, like, it's no question. This is what happens, is people get emotional and they go, hey, why not do this? Nylander last year was the Leafs' best player in the playoffs. There's just no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. He started the season man on fire. I actually kind of think that Nylander, weirdly, is a big game player. I think he is. He's a Toronto guy. He's not going to go watch hockey at the Marlies game, but it's a high event situation. You get Leafs tickets, he'll show up. You know, you want to, Kanye's in town, he'll go to the concert, but he's not going to go see some small underground show and grind and have to get there. He is a Toronto guy. He is a big game player, in my opinion. I think he steps up and engages in a way when it matters more. And when it's a regular season game and it's a sleepy Monday night against the Montreal Canadiens and he's being asked to really kill himself in his own end, I think he's kind of like, nah, I'm not here for this. But he's incredibly
strong. That's why people hate him too, is right? They're like, put some effort in, and then he doesn't. They're like, well, you don't always do that.
Yeah, I don't know. I've kind of just come to grips with who Nylander is. And yes, in the off season, if this team fails again, and if they blow it in the first round and they have to tinker, or they feel as though there is a move where they improve because they get more balance down their roster and that didn't work out, fine. But no, I'm not just trading William Nylander because it's just a, like, I think the dumbest thing you can do is say we're trading this player because we're looking for X when you're talking about the Leafs. I think it's more of you shop a player, and if you end up getting a return back that is incredible, you make that move if you feel like you're actually winning. The problem is when you shop players and they find out about it, you lose those players in terms of their engagement, their mentality, all these different things. So it's a very dangerous game to be playing. Usually once that happens, they want to move on. We're in more of a player empowerment era across all sports, so it's a risky move to make. I don't know. I Nylander isn't the problem to me right now. Like, that's very, very far from my list of concerns. I understand that you're not saying that it's a problem, that you're saying that he's a position of strength to be able to acquire something. Just, all of a sudden, if you say you're trading Nylander and you add a defenseman, where am I getting my secondary scoring in the playoffs? Like, at least I trust Nylander to show up and score in those games if the top line goes a little dry. I like him in so many different scenarios. And so the guy who scored all the goals in the playoffs last year, you don't have him, well, then you scored no goals. I don't know. It's just you're robbing Peter to pay Paul.